"Mr. Marshall," said Jack, "pass the word for the carpenter, if you please. I have a guest coming aboard. We must do our best to make him comfortable. He is a physician, a great man in the philosophical line."
"An astronomer, sir?"
asked the master eagerly. "Rather more of a botanist, I take it," said Jack. "But I have great hopes that if we make him comfortable, he may stay with us as the Sophie's surgeon. Think what a famous thing that would be for the ship's company."
"Indeed it would, sir. They were right upset when Mr. Jackson went off to the palace, and to replace him with a physician would be a great stroke. There's one aboard the flagship and one at Gibraltar, but not another in the whole fleet, not that I know of. They charge a guinea a visit by land, or so I have heard tell."
"Even more, Mr. Marshall, even more. Is that water aboard?"
"All aboard and stowed, sir, except for the last two casks."
"There you are, Mr. Lamb. I want you to have a look at the bulkhead of my sleeping cabin and see what you can do to make it a little more roomy for a friend. You may be able to shift it forward a good 6 inches. Yes, Mr. Babington, what is it?"
"If you please, sir, the Burford is signalling over the headland."
"Very good. Now let the purser, the gunner and the boatswain know I want to see them."
From that moment on, the captain of the Sophie was plunged deep into her accounts. A muster book, slop book, tickets, sick book, complete book, gunners, boatswains, and carpenters' expenses, supplies and returns, general account of provisions received and returned, and quarterly account of same, together with certificates of the quantity of spirits, wine, cocoa, and tea issued, to say nothing of the log, letter, and order books. And what with having dined extremely well, and not being good with figures at any time, he very soon lost his footing. Most of his dealings were with Ricketts, the purser, and as Jack grew irritable in his confusion, it seemed to him that he detected a certain smoothness in the way the purser presented his interminable sums and balances. There were papers here, quittances, acknowledgments, and receipts that he was being asked to sign, and he knew very well that he did not understand them all.
"Mr. Ricketts," he said, at the end of a long, easy explanation that conveyed nothing to him at all, "here in the muster book, number 178, is Charles Stephen Ricketts."
"Yes, sir."
"My son, sir." "Just so. I see that he appeared on November 30th, 1797, from Tonnant, late Princess Royal. There is no age by his name."
"Ah, let me see. Charlie must have been rising 12 by then, sir."
"He was rated able seaman."
"Yes, sir. Ha ha."
It was a perfectly ordinary little everyday fraud, but it was illegal. Jack did not smile. He went on,
"A.B. to September 20th, 1798, then rated clerk, and then on November 10th, 1799, he was rated midshipman."
"Yes, sir,"
said the purser. Not only was there that little awkwardness of the 11-year-old able seaman, but Mr. Ricketts' quick ear caught the slight emphasis on the word rated, and its slightly unusual repetition. The message it conveyed was this:
"I may seem a poor man of business, but if you try any purser's tricks with me, I'm athwart your hawse, and I can rake you from stem to stern. What is more, one captain's rating can be disrated by another, and if you trouble my sleep, by God, I shall turn your boy before the mast, and flog the tender pink skin off his back every day for the rest of the commission."
Jack's head was aching. His eyes were slightly rimmed with red from the port, and there was so clear a hint of latent ferocity in them that the purser took the message very seriously.
"Yes, sir," he said again. "Yes. Now here is the list of dockyard tallies. Would you like me to explain the different headings in detail, sir?"
"If you please, Mr. Ricketts."
This was Jack's first direct, fully responsible acquaintance with bookkeeping, and he did not much relish it. Even a small vessel, and the Sophie barely exceeded 150 tons, needs a wonderful amount of stores. Casks of beef, pork, and butter, all numbered and signed for, puncheons, butts, and half-pieces of rum, hardtack by the ton from old Weevil, dried soup with a broad arrow upon it, quite apart from the gunner's powder, mealed, corned, and best patent, sponges, worms, matches, priming irons, wads, and shot, bar, chain, case, langrage, grape, or plain round, and the countless objects needed, and so very often embezzled, by the boatswain, the blocks, the long tackle, single, double, parrel, quarter coke, double coke, flat side, double thin coke, single thin coke, single strap bound and sister blocks alone made up a whole Lent litany. Here Jack was far more at home, for the difference between a single double scored and a single shoulder block was as clear to him as that between night and day, or right and wrong, far clearer on occasion. But by now his mind, used to grappling with concrete physical problems, was thoroughly tired. He looked wistfully over the dog-eared tatty books piled up on the curving rim of the lockers, out through the cabin windows at the brilliant air and the dancing sea. He passed his hand over his forehead and said,
"We will deal with the rest another time, Mr. Ricketts. What a goddamned great heap of paper it is, to be sure. I see that a clerk is a very necessary member of the ship's company. That reminds me, I have appointed a young man. He will be coming aboard today. I'm sure you will ease him into his duties, Mr. Ricketts. He seems willing and competent, and he is nephew to Mr. Williams, the prize agent. I think it is to the Sophie's advantage that we should be well with the prize agent, Mr. Ricketts."
"Indeed it is, sir," said the purser, with deep conviction.
"Now I must go across to the dockyard with the boatswain before the evening gun," said Jack, escaping into the open air.
As he set foot upon deck, so young Richards came up the larboard side, accompanied by a negro, well over 6 feet tall.
"Here is the young man I was telling you about, Mr. Ricketts. And this is the seaman you have brought me, Mr. Richards. A fine, stout fellow he looks, too. What is his name?"
"Alfred King, if you please, sir."
"Can you hand reef and steer, King?"
The negro nodded his round head. There was a fine flash of white across his face, and he grunted aloud. Jack frowned, for this was no way to address a captain on his own quarter-deck.
"Come, sir," he said sharply. "Haven't you got a civil tongue in your head?"
Looking suddenly grey and apprehensive, the negro shook his head.
"If you please, sir," said the clerk, "he has no tongue. The Moors cut it out."
"Oh," said Jack, taken aback. "Oh, well, stow him for it. I will read him in by and by. Mr. Babington, take Mr. Richards below and show him the midshipman's berth. Come, Mr. Watt, we must get to the dockyard before the idle dogs stop work altogether." "There is a man to gladden your heart, Mr. Watt," said Jack, as the cutter sped across the harbour. "I wish I could find another score or so like him. You don't seem very taken with the idea, Mr. Watt."
"Well, sir, I should never say no to a prime seaman, to be sure. And to be sure we could swap some of our landmen, not that we have many left, being as we've been in commission so long, and them as was going to run having run, and most of the rest rated ordinary, if not able."
The boatswain could not find his way out of his parenthesis, and after a staring pause he wound up by saying,
"But as for mere numbers, why, no, sir.
Not even with the draft for harbour duties?"
"Why, bless you, sir, they never amounted to half a dozen, and we took good care they was all the hard bargains and right awkward buggers. Beg pardon, sir, the idle men. So as for mere numbers, why, no, sir. In a three-watch brig like the Sophie, it's a puzzle to stow 'em all between decks as it is. She's a trim, comfortable, home-like little vessel, right enough, but she ain't what you might call roomy."
Jack made no reply to this, but it confirmed a good many of his impressions, and he reflected upon them until the boat reached the yard.
"Captain Aubrey!"
cried Mr. Brown, the officer in charge of the yard.
"Let me shake you by the hand, sir, and wish you joy. I am very happy to see you."
"Thank you, sir. Thank you very much indeed."
They shook hands.
"This is the first time I've seen you in your kingdom, sir."
"Commodious, ain't it?" said the naval officer. "A rope walk over there. Sail loft behind your old genero. I only wish there were a higher wall around the timber yard. You would never believe how many flaming thieves there are in this island, that creep over the wall by night and take away my spars, or try to. It is my belief they are sometimes set on it by the captains. But captains or not, I shall crucify the next son of a bitch I find so much as looking at a dog-paw."
"It is my belief, Mr. Brown, that you will never be really happy until there is not a king's ship left in the Mediterranean, and you can walk around your yard mustering a full complement of paint-pots every day of the week, never issuing out so much as a tree-nail from one year's end to the next."
"You just listen to me, young man," said Mr. Brown, laying his hand on Jack's sleeve. "Just you listen to age and experience. Your good captain never wants anything from a dockyard. He makes do with what he has. He takes great care of the king's stores. Nothing is ever wasted. He pays his bottom with his own slush. He worms his cables deep with twice-laid stuff, and serves and parcels them so there is never any fretting in the hawse anywhere. He cares for his sails far more than for his own skin, and he never sets his royals. Nasty, unnecessary flash, gimcrack things. And the result is promotion, Mr. Aubrey, for we make our report to the Admiralty, as you know, and it carries the greatest possible weight. What made Trotter a post-captain?
The fact that he was the most economical master and commander on the station. Some men carried away topmasts 2 and 3 times in a year. Never Trotter. Take your good Captain Allen. Never did he come to me with one of those horrible lists as long as his own pennant. And look at him now, in command of as pretty a frigate as he could wish. But why do I tell you all this, Captain Aubrey? I know very well you are not one of these spendthrift, fling-it-down-the-kennel young commanders, not after the care you took bringing in the Genereux. Besides, the Sophie is perfectly well-found in every possible respect, except, conceivably, in the article of paint. I might, at great inconvenience to other captains, find you some yellow paint, a very little yellow paint.
"Why, sir, I should be grateful for a pot or two," said Jack, his eye ranging carelessly over the spars. "But what I really came for was to beg the favour of the loan of your duettos. I'm taking a friend on this cruise, and he particularly desires to hear your B minor duetto."
"You shall have them, Captain Aubrey," said Mr. Brown. "You shall most certainly have them. Mrs. Hart is transcribing one for the harp at the present moment, but I shall step round there directly. When do you sail?"
"As soon as I have completed my water and my convoy is assembled."
"That will be tomorrow evening, if the Fanny comes in, and the watering will not take you long. The Sophie only carries 10 ton. You shall have the book by noon tomorrow, I promise you."
"I am most obliged, Mr. Brown, infinitely obliged. Good night to you, then, and my best respects wait on Mrs. Brown and Miss Fanny." "Christ!" said Jack, as the shattering din of the carpenter's hammer prized him from his hold on sleep. He clung to the soft darkness as hard as he could, burying his face in his pillow, for his mind had been racing so that he had not dropped off until 6. Indeed, it was his appearance on deck at first light, peering at the yards and rigging, that had given rise to the rumour that he was up and about. And this was the reason for the carpenter's untimely zeal, just as it was for the nervous presence of the gunroom steward. The former captain's steward had gone over to the Palace, hovering with what had been Captain Allen's invariable breakfast, a mug of small beer, hominy grits, and cold beef. But there was no sleeping. The echoing crash of the hammer right next to his ear, ludicrously followed by the sound of whispering between the carpenter and his mates, made certain of that. They were in his sleeping cabin, of course. Jets of pain shot through Jack's head as he lay there.
"What's that bloody hammering?" he called,
and almost against his shoulder came the shocked reply,
"Aye, aye, sir,"
and the tiptoe pittering away. His voice was hoarse.
"What made me so damned garrulous yesterday?"
he said, still lying there in his cot.
"I'm as hoarse as a crow with talking, and what made me launch out in wild invitations? A guest I know nothing about, in a very small brig I have scarcely seen."
He pondered gloomily upon the extreme care that should be taken with shipmates, cheek by jowl, very like marriage, the inconvenience of pragmatic, touchy, assuming companions, incompatible tempers mewed up together in a box. In a box. His manual of seamanship, and how he had conned it as a boy, poring over the impossible equations. Let the angle YCB to which the yard is braced up be called the trim of the sails, and expressed by the symbol B. This is the complement of the angle DCI. Now, CI colon ID equals rad colon tan. DCI equals capital I colon tan. DCI equals slash colon cotan B. Therefore, we have finally slash colon cotan B equals A to the power of 1 colon B to the power of 1 tan squared X and A to the power of 1. Cotan B equals capital B angent to the power of 2, and tan power of 1, x, equals capital A over capital B, cotan. This equation evidently ascertains the mutual relation between the trim of the sails and the leeway.
"It is quite evident, is it not, Jackie darling?"
said a hopeful voice, and a rather large young woman bent kindly over him. For at this stage in his memory he was only 12, a stocky little boy, and tall, nubile Queenie sailed high above.
"Why, no, Queenie," said the infant Jack. "To tell you the truth, it ain't." "Well," said she, with untiring patience, "try to remember what a cotangent is, and let us begin again. Let us consider the ship as an oblong box."
For a while he considered the Sophie as an oblong box.
He had not seen a great deal of her, but there were two or three fundamentals that he knew with absolute certainty. One was that she was under-rigged. She might be well enough close to the wind, but she would be a slug before it. Another was that his predecessor had been a man of a temper entirely unlike his own, and another was that the Sophie's people had come to resemble their captain. A good, sound, quiet, careful, unaggressive commander, who never set his royals, as brave as could be when set upon, but the very opposite of a Sally Rover.
"Was discipline to be combined with the spirit of a Sally Rover," said Jack, "it would sweep the ocean clean."
And his mind, descending fast to the commonplace, dwelt on the prize money that would result from sweeping the ocean even moderately clean.
"That despicable Maynard," he said, "and surely to God I can get a couple of 12-pounders as chasers. Would her timbers stand it, though? But whether they can or not, the box can be made a little more like a fighting vessel, more like a real man of war."
As his thoughts ranged on, so the low cabin brightened steadily. A fishing boat passed under the Sophie's stern, laden with tunny and uttering the harsh roar of a conch. At almost the same time, the sun popped up from behind St. Philip's Fort. It did, in fact, pop up, flattened like a sideways lemon in the morning haze and drawing its bottom free of the land with a distinct jerk. In little more than a minute, the greyness of the cabin had utterly vanished. The deckhead was alive with light glancing from the rippling sea, and a single ray, reflected from some unmoving surface on the distant quay, darted through the cabin windows to light up Jack's coat and its blazing epaulet. The sun rose within his mind, obliging his dogged look to broaden into a smile, and he swung out of his cot. The sun had reached Dr. Maturin 10 minutes earlier, for he was a good deal higher up. He, too, stirred and turned away, for he, too, had slept uneasily, but the brilliance prevailed. He opened his eyes and stared about very stupidly. A moment before he had been so solidly, so warmly and happily in Ireland, with a girl's hand under his arm, that his waking mind could not take in the world he saw. Her touch was still firm upon his arm, and even her scent was there. Vaguely he picked at the crushed leaves under him. Dianthus profragrans. The scent was reclassified. A flower, and nothing more. And the ghostly contact, the firm print of fingers, vanished. His face reflected the most piercing unhappiness, and his eyes misted over. He had been exceedingly attached, and she was so bound up with that time. He had been quite unprepared for this particular blow, striking under every conceivable kind of armour, and for some minutes he could hardly bear the pain, but sat there, blinking in the sun. "Christ," he said at last, "another day." With this his face grew more composed. He stood up, beat the white dust from his breeches, and took off his coat to shake it. With intense mortification, he saw that the piece of meat he had hidden at yesterday's dinner had oozed grease through his handkerchief and his pocket. "How wonderfully strange," he thought, "to be upset by this trifle. Yet I am upset." He sat down and ate the piece of meat, the eye of a mutton chop, and for a moment his mind dwelt on the theory of counter-irritants, Paracelsus, Cardan, Rhazes. He was sitting in the ruined apse of St. Damien's Chapel, high above Port Mahon on the north side, looking down upon the great winding inlet of the harbour, and far out beyond it over a vast expanse of sea, a variegated blue with wandering lanes. The flawless sun, a hand's breadth high, rising from the side of Africa. He had taken refuge there some days before, as soon as his landlord began to grow a shade uncivil. He had not waited for a scene, for he was too emotionally worn to put up with any such thing. Presently he took notice of the ants that were taking away his crumbs, Tapinoma erraticum. They were walking in a steady two-way stream across the hollow, or dell, of his inverted wig, as it lay there looking very like an abandoned bird's nest, though once it had been as neat a physical bob as had ever been seen in Stephen's Green. They hurried along with their abdomens high, jostling, running into one another. His gaze followed the wearisome little creatures, and while he was watching them, a toad was watching him. Their eyes met, and he smiled. A splendid toad. A 2-pound toad with brilliant tawny eyes. How did he manage to make a living in the sparse, thin grass of that stony, sun-beaten landscape, so severe and parched, with no more cover than a few tumbles of pale stone, a few low-creeping, hook-thorned caper-bushes, and a cistus whose name Stephen did not know? Most remarkably severe and parched, for the winter of 1799 to 1800 had been uncommonly dry. The March rains had failed, and now the heat had come very early in the year. Very gently he stretched out his finger and stroked the toad's throat. The toad swelled a little, and moved its crossed hands, then sat easy, gazing back. The sun rose and rose. The night had not been cold at any time, but still the warmth was grateful. Black wheat ears that must have a brood not far, one of the smaller eagles in the sky. There was a sloughed snake skin in the bush where he pissed, and its eye covers were perfect, startlingly crystalline.
"What am I to think of Captain Aubrey's invitation?" he said aloud, in that great emptiness of light and air. All the more vast for the inhabited patch down there, and its movement, and the checkered fields behind, fading into pale, dun, formless hills. Was it merely Jack ashore? Yet he was such a pleasant, ingenuous companion.
He smiled at the recollection.
Still and all, what weight can be attached to? We had dined extremely well, 4 bottles, or possibly 5. I must not expose myself to an affront.
He turned it over and over, arguing against his hopes, but coming at last to the conclusion that if he could make his coat passably respectable, and the dust does seem to be getting it off, or at least disguising it, he said, he would call on Mr. Florey at the hospital and talk to him in a general way about the naval surgeon's calling. He brushed the ants from his wig and settled it on his head. Then, as he walked down towards the edge of the road, the magenta spikes of gladioli in the taller grass, the recollection of that unlucky name stopped him in his stride. How had he come to forget it so entirely in his sleep? How was it possible that the name James Dillon had not presented itself at once to his waking mind?
"Yet it is true there are hundreds of Dillons," he reflected, "and a great many of them are called James, of course."
"Christie!" hummed James Dillon under his breath, shaving the red-gold bristles off his face in what light could make its way through the scuttle of the Burford's No. 12 gunport. "Christe eleison, Kyrie!"
This was less piety in James Dillon than a way of hoping he should not cut himself, for like so many papists, he was somewhat given to blasphemy. The difficulty of the planes under his nose silenced him, however, and when his upper lip was clean he could not hit the note again. In any case, his mind was too busy to be seeking after an elusive noom, for he was about to report to a new captain, a man upon whom his comfort and ease of mind was to depend, to say nothing of his reputation, career, and prospects of advancement. Stroking his shining smoothness, he hurried out into the wardroom and shouted for a marine.
"Just brush the back of my coat, will you, Curtis? My chest is quite ready, and the bread sack of books is to go with it," he said. "Is the captain on deck?"
"Oh, no, sir, no," said the marine. "Breakfast only just carrying in this moment. 2 hard-boiled eggs and 1 soft.
The soft-boiled egg was for Miss Smith, to recruit her from her labours of the night, as both the marine and Mr. Dillon knew very well, but the marine's knowing look met with a total lack of response. James Dillon's mouth tightened, and for a fleeting moment, as he ran up the ladder to the sudden brilliance of the quarter-deck, it wore a positively angry expression. Here he greeted the officer of the watch and the Burford's first lieutenant.
"Good morning. Good morning to you. My word, you're very fine," they said. "There she lies, just beyond the Genereux."
His eyes ranged over the busy harbour. The light was so nearly horizontal that all the masts and yards assumed a strange importance, and the little skipping waves sent back a blinding sparkle.
"No, no," they said. "Over by the sheer hulk. The felucca has just masked her. There, now do you see her?"
He did indeed. He had been looking far too high, and his gaze had swept right over the Sophie as she lay there, not much above a cable's length away, very low in the water. He leant both hands on the rail, and looked at her with unwinking concentration. After a while he borrowed the telescope from the officer of the watch, and did the same again, with a most searching, minute scrutiny. He could see the gleam of an epaulet, whose wearer could only be her captain, and her people were as active as bees just about to swarm. He had been prepared for a little brig, but not for quite such a dwarfish vessel as this. Most 14-gun sloops were between 200 and 250 tons in burthen. The Sophie could scarcely be more than 150.
"I like a little quarter-deck," said the officer of the watch. "She was the Spanish Vencejo, was she not? And as for being rather low, why, anything you look at close to from a 74 looks rather low."
There were three things that everybody knew about the Sophie. One was that, unlike almost all other brigs, she had a quarter-deck. Another was that she had been Spanish. And a third was that she possessed an elm-tree pump on her forecastle, that is to say, a bored-out trunk that communicated directly with the sea and that was used for washing her deck. An insignificant piece of equipment, really, but one so far above her station that no mariner who saw it or heard of this pump ever forgot it.
"Maybe your quarters will be a little cramped," said the first lieutenant, "but you will have a quiet, restful time of it, I'm sure, convoying the trade up and down the Mediterranean."
"Well," said James Dillon, unable to find a brisk retort to this possibly well-intentioned kindness.
"Well," he said with a philosophical shrug, "you'll let me have a boat, sir. I should like to report as early as I can." "A boat? God rot my soul," cried the first lieutenant. "I shall be asked for the barge next thing I know. Passengers in the Burford wait for a bumboat from shore, Mr. Dillon, or else they swim."
He stared at James with cold severity, until the quartermaster's chuckle betrayed him, for Mr. Coffin was a great wag, a wag even before breakfast.
"Dillon, sir, reporting for duty, if you please," said James, taking off his hat in the brilliant sun and displaying a blaze of dark red hair.
"Welcome aboard, Mr. Dillon," said Jack, touching his own, holding out his hand and looking at him with so intense a desire to know what kind of man he was that his face had an almost forbidding acuity. "You would be welcome in any case, but even more so this morning. We have a busy day ahead of us. Masthead there, any sign of life on the wharf?"
"Nothing yet, sir."
"The wind is exactly where I want it," said Jack,
looking for the hundredth time at the rare white clouds sailing evenly across the perfect sky.
"But with this rising glass there is no trusting to it."
"Your coffee's up, sir," said the steward.
"Thank you, Kiddick. What is it, Mr. Lamb?"
"I haven't no ring-bolts anywhere near big enough, sir," said the carpenter.
"But there's a heap on 'em at the yard, I know.
May I send over?"
"No, Mr. Lamb. Don't you go near that yard to save your life. Double the clench bolts you have. Set up the forge and fashion a serviceable ring. It won't take you half an hour. Now, Mr. Dillon, when you have settled in comfortably below, perhaps you will come and drink a cup of coffee with me, and I will tell you what I have in mind."
James hurried below to the three-cornered booth that he was to live in, whipped out of his reporting uniform into trousers and an old blue coat, reappearing while Jack was still blowing thoughtfully upon his cup.
"Sit down, Mr. Dillon, sit down," he cried. "Push those papers aside. It's a sad brew, I'm afraid, but at least it is wet, that I can promise you. Sugar?"
"If you please, sir," said young Ricketts, "the Generose cutter is alongside with the men who were drafted off for harbour duty."
"All of them?"
"All except two, sir, that have been changed."
Still holding his coffee cup, Jack writhed from behind the table and with a twist of his body out through the door. Hooked on to the larboard main chains, there was the Generose's boat, filled with seamen, looking up, laughing and exchanging witticisms, or mere hoots and whistles with their former shipmates. The Generose's midshipman saluted and said,
"Captain Hart's compliments, sir, and he finds the draft can be spared."
"God bless your heart, dear Molly," said Jack.
And aloud,
"My compliments and best thanks to Captain Hart. Be so good as to send them aboard."
There were not much to look at, he reflected, as the whip from the yardarm hoisted up their meagre belongings. Three or four were decidedly simple, and two others had that indefinable air of men of some parts whose cleverness sets them apart from their fellows, but not nearly so far as they imagine. Two of the boobies were quite horribly dirty, and one had managed to exchange his slops for a red garment with remains of tinsel upon it. Still, they all possessed two hands. They could all clap on to a rope, and it would be strange if the boatswain and his mates could not induce them to heave.
"Deck!" hailed the midshipman aloft. "Deck! There is someone moving about on the wharf."
"Very good, Mr. Babington. You may come down and have your breakfast now." "Six hands I thought lost for good," he said to James Dillon with intense satisfaction, turning back to the cabin. "They may not be much to look at.
Indeed, I think we must rig a tub if we're not to have an itchy ship. But they will help us weigh, and I hope to weigh by 9:30 at the latest."
Jack wrapped the brass-bound wood of the locker and went on.
"We will ship 2 long 12s as chase pieces, if I can get them from ordnance. But whether or no, I'm going to take the sloop out while this breeze lasts, to try her paces. We convoy 12 merchantmen to Cagliari, sailing this evening if they're all here, and we must know how she handles. Yes, Mr.
"Pullin, sir, master's mate. Burford's longboat alongside with a draft."
"A draft for us? How many?"
18, sir."
"And rum-looking cullies some of 'em are," he would have added, if he had dared.
"Do you know anything about them, Mr. Dillon?" asked Jack.
"I knew the Burford had a good many of the Charlotte's people, and some from the receiving ships as drafts for Mahone, sir, but I never heard of any being meant for the Sophie."
Jack was on the point of saying,
"And there I was, worrying about being stripped bare."
But he contented himself with chuckling, and wondering why this cornucopia should have poured itself out on him.
"Lady Warren,"
came the reply, in a flash of revelation. He laughed again, and said,
"Now I'm going across to the wharf, Mr. Dillon. Mr. Head is a businesslike man, and he will tell me whether the guns are to be had or not within 30 minutes. If they are, I will break out my handkerchief, and you can start carrying out the warps directly. What now, Mr. Richards?"
"Sir," said the pale clerk, "Mr. Percy says I should bring you the receipts and letters to sign this time every day, and the fair-copied book to read."
"Quite right," said Jack mildly. "Every ordinary day. Presently you will learn which is ordinary and which is not."
He glanced at his watch.
"Here are the receipts for the men. Show me the rest another time."
The scene on deck was not unlike Cheapside, with roadwork going on. 2 parties under the carpenter and his crew were making ready the places for the hypothetical bow and stern chasers, and parcels of assorted landmen and boobies stood about with their baggage, some watching the work with an interested air, offering comments, others gaping vacantly about, gazing into the sky as though they had never seen it before. 1 or 2 had even edged on to the holy quarter-deck.
"What in God's name is this infernal confusion?"
cried Jack.
"Mr. Watt, this is a king's ship, not the Margate Hoy. You, sir, get away for it!"
For a moment, until his unaffected blaze of indignation galvanized them into activity, the Sophie's warrant officers gazed at him sadly. He caught the words, "All these people."
"I'm going ashore," he went on. "By the time I come back, this deck will present a very different appearance."
He was still red in the face as he went down into the boat after the midshipman.
"Do they really imagine I shall leave an able-bodied man on shore if I can cram him aboard?"
he said to himself.
"Of course, their precious 3 watches will have to go. And even so, 14 inches will be hard to find."
The 3-watch system was a humane arrangement that allowed the men to sleep a whole night through from time to time, whereas with 2 watches, 4 hours was the most they could ever hope for. But on the other hand, it did mean that half the men had the whole of the available space to sling their hammocks, since the other half was on deck.
18 and 6 is 24, said Jack, "and 50 or thereabout, say 75. And of those, how many shall I watch?"
He worked out this figure in order to multiply it by 14, for 14 inches was the space the regulations allowed for each hammock, and it seemed to him very doubtful whether the Sophie possessed anything like that amount of room, whatever her official complement might be. He was still working at it when the midshipman called,
"Unrow, boat your oars,"
and they kissed gently against the wharf.
"Go back to the ship now, Mr. Ricketts," said Jack on an impulse. "I do not suppose I shall be long, and it may save a few minutes."
But with the Burford's draft, he had missed his chance. Other captains were there before him now, and he had to wait his turn. He walked up and down in the brilliant morning sun with one whose epaulette matched his own, Middleton, whose greater pull had enabled him to snap up the command of the Vertus, the charming French privateer that would have been Jack's had there been any justice in the world. When they had exchanged the naval gossip of the Mediterranean, Jack remarked that he had come for a couple of 12-pounders.
"Do you think she'll bear them?"
asked Middleton.
"I hope so. Your 4-pounder is a pitiful thing, though I must confess I feel anxious for her knees."
"Well, I hope so, too," said Middleton, shaking his head. "At all events, you have come on the right day. It seems that Head is to be placed under Brown, and he has taken such a spite at it that he is selling off his stock like a fishwife at the end of the fair."
Jack had already heard something of this development in the long, long squabble between the Ordnance Board and the Navy Board, and he longed to hear more. But at this moment Captain Halliwell came out, smiling all over his face, and Middleton, who had some faint remains of conscience, said, "You take my turn. I shall be an age with all my carronades to explain."
"Good morning, sir," said Jack. "I'm Aubrey, of the Sophie, and I should like to try a couple of long twelves, if you please."
With no change in his melancholy expression, Mr. Head said,
"You know what they weight?"
"Something in the nature of 3,300 weight, I believe."
3,300 weight, 3 pounds, 3 ounces, 3 pennyweight. Have a dozen, Captain, if you feel she will bear them."
"Thank you. 2 will be plenty," said Jack,
looking sharply to see whether he were being made game of.
"They are yours, then, and upon your own head be it," said Mr. Head with a sigh,
making secret marks upon a worn, curling parchment slip.
"Give it to the Master Parker, and he will troll you out as pretty a pair as ever the heart of man could desire. I have some neat mortars, if you have room."
"I am extremely obliged to you, Mr. Head," said Jack, laughing with pleasure. "I wish the rest of the service were run so."
"So do I, Captain, so do I,"
cried Mr. Head, his face growing suddenly dark with passion.
"There are some slack-assed, bloody-minded men, flute-playing, fiddle-scraping, present-seeking, tail-bearing, double-poxed hounds that will keep you waiting about for a month. But I am not one of them."
"Captain Middleton, sir. Carronades for you, I presume?"
In the sunlight once more, Jack threw out his signal, and peering among the masts and criss-crossed yards, he saw a figure at the Sophie's masthead bend as though to hail the deck, before disappearing down a backstay like a bead sliding upon a thread. Expedition was Mr. Head's watchword, but the Master Parker of the Ordnance Wharf did not seem to have heard of it. He showed Jack the 2 12-pounders with great goodwill.
"As pretty a pair as the heart of man could desire," he said, stroking their cascabels as Jack signed for them.
But after that his mood seemed to change. There were several other captains in front of Jack. Fair was fair, turn and turn about. Them 36s were all in the way and would have to be moved first. He was precious short of hands. The Sophie had warped in long ago, and she was lying neatly against the dock right under the derricks. There was more noise aboard her than there had been, more noise than was right, even with a relaxed harbour discipline, and he was sure some of the men had managed to get drunk already. Expectant faces, a good deal less expectant now, looked over her side at her captain as he paced up and down, glancing now at his watch and now at the sky.
"My God!" he cried, clapping his hand to his forehead. "What a damn fool! I clean forgot the oil!"
Turning short in his stride, he hurried over to the shed, where a violent squealing showed that the Master Parker and his mates were trundling the slides of Middleton's carronades towards the neat line of their barrels.
"Master Parker!" called Jack. "Come and look at my 12-pounders. I've been in such a hurry all morning that I do believe I forgot to anoint them."
With these words he privately laid down a gold piece upon each touch-hole, and a slow look of approval appeared on the Parker's face.
"If my gunner had not been sick he would have reminded me," added Jack.
"Well, thank ye, sir. It always has been the custom, and I don't like to see the old ways die, I do confess,"
said the Parker, with some still unevaporated surliness. But then, brightening progressively, he said,
"Hurry, you mentioned, Captain. I'll see what we can do."
5 minutes later the bow chaser, neatly slung by its train-loops, side-loops, pomelian and muzzle, floated gently over the Sophie's forecastle, within half an inch of its ideal resting-place. Jack and the carpenter were on all fours, side by side, rather as though they were playing bears, and they were listening for the sound her beams and timbers would make as the strain came off the derrick. Jack beckoned with his hand, calling,
"Handsomely! Handsomely now!"
The Sophie was perfectly silent, all her people watching intently, even the tub party with their buckets poised, even the human chain who were tossing the 12-pound round shot from the shore to the side, and so down to the gunner's mate in the shot-locker. The gun touched, sat firm. There was a deep, not unhealthy, creaking, and the Sophie settled a little by the head.
"Capital,"
said Jack, surveying the gun as it stood there, well within its chalked-out space.
"Plenty of room all round. Great oceans of room, upon my word," he said, backing a step.
In his haste to avoid being trodden down, the gunner's mate behind him collided with his neighbour, who ran into his, setting off a chain reaction in that crowded, roughly triangular space between the foremast and the stem that resulted in the maiming of one ship's boy and very nearly in the watery death of another.
"Where's the bosun? Now, Mr. Watt, let me see the tackles rigged. You want a hard-eye becket on that block. Where's the breeching?"
"Almost ready, sir," said the sweating, harassed bosun. "I'm working the cunt splice myself."
"Well," said Jack,
hurrying off to where the stern chaser hung poised above the Sophie's quarter-deck, ready to plunge through her bottom if gravity could but have its way.
"A simple thing like a cunt splice will not take a man-of-war's bosun long, I believe. Set those men to work, Mr. Lamb, if you please. This is not Fiddler's Green."
He looked at his watch again.
"Mr. Mowat,"
he said, looking at a cheerful young master's mate. Mr. Mowat's cheerful look changed to one of extreme gravity.
"Mr. Mowat, do you know Joselito's coffee-house?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then be so good as to go there and ask for Dr. Maturin. My compliments, and I am very much concerned to say we shall not be back in port by dinner-time, but I will send a boat this evening at any time he chooses to appoint."
They were not back in port by dinner-time. It would indeed have been a logical impossibility, since they had not yet left it, but were sweeping majestically through the close-packed craft towards the fairway. One advantage of having a small vessel with a great many hands aboard is that you can execute manoeuvres denied to any ship of the line, and Jack preferred this arduous creeping to being towed, or to threading along under sail with a thoroughly uneasy crew disturbed in all their settled habits and jostling full of strangers. In the open channel he had himself rowed round the Sophie. He considered her from every angle, and at the same time he weighed the advantages and disadvantages of sending all the women ashore. It would be easy to find most of them while the men were at their dinner, not merely the local girls who were there for fun and pocket money, but also the semi-permanent Judies. If he made one sweep now, then another just before their true departure might clear the sloop entirely. He wanted no women aboard. They only caused trouble, and with this fresh influx they would cause even more. On the other hand, there was a certain lack of zeal aboard, a lack of real spring, and he did not mean to turn it into sullenness, particularly that afternoon. Sailors were as conservative as cats, as he knew very well. They would put up with incredible labour and hardship, to say nothing of danger, but it had to be what they were used to, or they would grow brutish. She was very low in the water, to be sure, a little by the head and listing a trifle to port. All that extra weight would have been far better below the waterline, but he would have to see how she handled.
"Shall I send the hands to dinner, sir?" asked James Dillon when Jack was aboard again.
"No, Mr. Dillon, we must profit by this wind. Once we are past the Cape, they may go below. Those guns are breached and frapped?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then we will make sail. In sweeps. All hands to make sail."
The bosun sprang his call and hurried away to the forecastle amidst a great rushing of feet and a good deal of bellowing.
"Newcomers below! Silence there!"
Another rush of feet. The Sophie's regular crew stood poised in their usual places, in dead silence. A voice on board the General, a cable's length away, could be heard quite clear and plain.
"Sophie's making sail!"
She lay there, rocking gently out in Mahone Harbour, with the shipping on her starboard beam and quarter, and the brilliant town beyond it. The breeze a little abaft her larboard beam, a northerly wind, was pushing her stern round a trifle. Jack paused, and as it came just so, he cried,
"Away aloft!"
The calls repeated the order, and instantly the shrouds were dark with passing men, racing up as though on their stairs at home.
"Trice up! Lay out!"
The calls again, and the topmen hurried out on the yards. They cast off the gaskets, the lines that held the sails tight furled to the yards. They gathered the canvas under their arms and waited.
"Let fall!"
came the order, and with it the howling peep, 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 peep from the bosun and his mates.
"Sheet home! Sheet home! Hoist away! Cheerly there in the foretop, look alive! T'gunsel sheets! Hands to the braces! Belay!"
A gentle push from above heeled the Sophie over, then another and another, each more delightfully urgent until it was one steady thrust. She was under way, and all along her side there sang a run of living water. Jack and his lieutenant exchanged a glance. It had not been bad. The Fortegansel had taken its time because of a misunderstanding as to how newcomer should be defined, and whether the six restored sophies were to be considered in that injurious light, which had led to a furious, silent squabble on the yard, and the sheeting home had been rather spasmodic. But it had not been disgraceful, and they would not have to support the derision of the other men of war in the harbour. There had been moments in the confusion of the morning when each had dreaded just that thing. The Sophie had spread her wings a little more like an unhurried dove than an eager hawk, but not so much so that the expert eyes on shore would dwell upon her with disapprobation, and as for the mere landsmen, their eyes were so satiated with the coming and going of every kind of vessel that they passed over her departure with glassy indifference.
"Forgive me, sir," said Stephen Maturin, touching his hat to a nautical gentleman on the quay, "but might I ask whether you know which is the ship called Sophia?"
"A king's ship, sir?" asked the officer, returning his salute. "A man of war? There is no ship of that name, but perhaps you refer to the sloop, sir, the sloop Sophie."
"That may well be the case, sir. No man could easily surpass me in ignorance of naval terms. The vessel I have in mind is commanded by Captain Aubrey."
"Just so. The sloop, the 14-gun sloop. She lies almost directly in front of you, sir, in a line with a little white house on the point."
"The ship with triangular sails?"
No, that is a Pole Cassetti. Somewhat to the left, and farther off."
"The little, small, squat merchantman with two masts?"
"Well," with a laugh, "she is a trifle low in the water, but she is a man of war, I assure you, and I believe she is about to make sail. Yes, there go her topsails, sheeted home. They hoist the yard, t'gansels. What's amiss? Ah, there we are. Not very smartly done, but all's well that ends well. And the Sophie never was one of your very brisk performers. See, she gathers way. She will fetch the mouth of the harbour on this wind without touching a brace."
"She is sailing away?"
"Indeed she is. She must be running 3 knots already, maybe 4.
"I'm very much obliged to you, sir," said Stephen, lifting his hat.
"Servant, sir," said the officer, lifting his.
He looked after Stephen for a while.
"Should I ask him whether he is well? I have left it too late. However, he seems steady enough now."
Stephen had walked down to the quay to find out whether the Sophie could be reached on foot, or whether he should have to take a boat to keep his dinner engagement, for his conversation with Mr. Florey had persuaded him that not only was the engagement intended to be kept, but that the more general invitation was equally serious, an eminently practicable suggestion, most certainly to be acted upon. How civil, how more than civil, Florey had been, had explained the medical service of the Royal Navy, and taken him to see Mr. Edwards of the Centaur perform quite an interesting amputation, had dismissed his scruples as to lack of purely surgical experience, had lent him Blaine on diseases incident to seamen, Hume's Libellus de Natura Scorbuti, Lynn's Effectual Means, and Northcott's Marine Practice, and had promised to find him at least the bare essentials in instruments until he should have his allowance and the official chest. "There are trochars, tenaculums, and ball scoops lying about by the dozen at the hospital, to say nothing of saws and bone rasps." Stephen had allowed his mind to convince itself entirely, and the strength of his emotion at the sight of the Sophie, her white sails and her low hull dwindling fast over the shining sea, showed him how much he had come to look forward to the prospect of a new place and new skies, a living and a closer acquaintance with this friend who was now running fast towards the quarantine island, behind which he would presently vanish. He walked up through the town with his mind in a curious state. He had suffered so many disappointments recently that it did not seem possible he could bear another. What was more, he had allowed all his defences to disperse, unarmed. It was while he was reassembling them and calling out his reserves that his feet carried him past Joselito's coffee-house, and voices said, "There he is! Call out! Run after him! You'll catch him if you run!" He'd not been into the coffee-house that morning because it was a question either of paying for a cup of coffee or paying for a boat to row him out to the Sophie, and he had therefore been unavailable for the midshipman, who now came running along behind him.
"Dr. Maturin?" asked young Mowat, and stopped short, quite shocked by the pale glare of reptilian dislike.
However, he delivered his message,
and he was relieved to find that it was greeted with a far more human look.
"Most kind," said Stephen. "What do you imagine would be a convenient time, sir?"
"Oh, I suppose about 6 o'clock, sir," said Mowat.
"Then at 6 o'clock I shall be at the Crown Steps," said Stephen. "I am very much obliged to you, sir, for your diligence in finding me out."
They parted, with a bow apiece, and Stephen said privately, "I shall go across to the hospital and offer Mr. Florey my assistance. He has a compound fracture above the elbow that will call for primary resection of the joint. It is a great while since I felt the grind of bone under my saw," he added, smiling with anticipation. Cape Mola lay on their larboard quarter. The troubled blasts and calms caused by the heights and valleys along the great harbour's winding northern shore no longer buffeted them, and with an almost steady tramontana at north by east, the Sophie was running fast towards Italy under her courses, single-reefed topsails and t'gallants.
"Bring her up as close as she will lie," said Jack. "How near will she point, Mr. Marshall? 6?
"I don't she'll do as well as 6, sir," said the master, shaking his head. "She's a little sullen to-day with the extra weight for'ard."
Jack took the wheel, and as he did so, a last gust from the island staggered the sloop, sending white water along her lee rail, plucking Jack's hat from his head and streaming his bright yellow hair away to the south-southwest. The master leapt after the hat, snatched it from the seaman who had rescued it in the hammock netting, and solicitously wiping the cockade with his handkerchief, he stood by Jack's side, holding it with both hands.
"Oh, Sodom and Gomorrah is sweet on Goldilocks," murmured John Lane, foretopman, to his friend Thomas Gross.
Thomas winked his eye and jerked his head, but without any appearance of censure. They were concerned with the phenomenon, not with any moral judgment.
"Well, I hope he don't take it out of us too much, that's all, mate," he replied.
Jack let her pay off until the flurry was over, and then, as he began to bring her back, his hands strong on the spokes, so he came into direct contact with the living essence of the sloop. The vibration beneath his palm, something between a sound and a flow, came straight up from her rudder, and it joined with the innumerable rhythms, the creak and humming of her hull and rigging. The keen, clear wind swept in on his left cheek, and as he bore on the helm so the Sophie answered, quicker and more nervous than he had expected, closer and closer to the wind. They were all staring up and forward. At last, in spite of the fiddle-tight bowline, the fore-t'gansel shivered, and Jack eased off.
"East by north, a half north,"
he observed with satisfaction.
"Keep her so,"
he said to the timoneer, and gave the order, the long-expected and very welcome order, to pipe to dinner. Dinner, while the Sophie, as close-hauled on the larboard tack as she could be, made her offing into the lonely water where 12-pound cannonballs could do no harm, and where disaster could pass unnoticed. The miles streamed out behind her, her white path stretching straight and true a little south of west. Jack looked at it from his stern window with approval. Remarkably little leeway, and a good steady hand must be steering to keep that furrow so perfect in the sea. He was dining in a solitary state, a Spartan meal of sodden kid and cabbage mixed, and it was only when he realized that there was no one to whom he could impart the innumerable observations that came bubbling into his mind that he remembered. This was his first formal meal as a captain. He almost made a jocose remark about it to his steward, for he was in very high spirits too, but he checked himself. It would not do.
"I shall grow used to it in time," he said,
and looked again with loving relish at the sea. The guns were not a success. Even with only half a cartridge, the bow chaser recoiled so strongly that at the third discharge the carpenter came running up on deck, so pale and perturbed that all discipline went by the board.
"Don't he do it, sir!"
he cried, covering the touch-hole with his hand.
"If you could but see her poor knees! And the spurcatin started in 5 separate places! Oh dear, oh dear!"
The poor man hurried to the ring-bolts of the breeching.
"There, I knew it! My clench is half-drawn in this poor thin old stuff! Why didn't you tell me, Tom?"
he cried, gazing reproachfully at his mate.
"I dursn't," said Tom, hanging his head. "It won't do, sir," said the carpenter. "Not with these here timbers, it won't. Not with this here deck."
Jack felt his collar rising. It was a ludicrous situation on the overcrowded forecastle, with the carpenter crawling about at his feet in apparent supplication, peering at the seams, and this was no sort of a way to address a captain. But there was no resisting Mr. Lamb's total sincerity, particularly as Jack secretly agreed with him. The force of the recoil, all that weight of metal darting back and being brought up with a twang by the breaching, was too much, far too much, for the Sophie. Furthermore, there really was not room to work the ship with the 2 12-pounders and their tackle filling so much of what little space there was. But he was bitterly disappointed. A 12-pound ball could pierce at 500 yards. It could send up a shower of lethal splinters, carry away a yard, do great execution. He tossed one up and down in his hand, considering. Whereas at any range a 4-pounder...
"And was you to fire off t'other one?" said Mr. Lamb with desperate courage, still on his hands and knees. "Your visitor wouldn't have a dry stitch on him, for the seams have opened something cruel."
William Jevons, carpenter's crew, came up and whispered,
"Foot of water in the well,"
in a rumble that could have been heard at the masthead. The carpenter stood up, put on his hat, touched it, and reported,
"There is a foot of water in the well, sir."
"Very well, Mr. Lamb," said Jack placidly. "We'll pump it out again. Mr. Day," he said, turning to the gunner, who had crawled up on deck for the firing of the 12-pounders,
would have crept out of his grave had he been in it.
"Mr. Day, draw and house the guns, if you please, and bosun, man the chain pump."
He patted the warm barrel of the 12-pounder regretfully and walked aft. He was not particularly worried about the water. The Sophie had been capering about in a lively way with this short sea coming across, and she would have made a good deal by her natural working. But he was vexed about the chasers, profoundly vexed, and he looked with even greater malignance at the mainyard.
"We shall have to get the t'gallants off her presently, Mr. Dillon," he observed, picking up the traverse board.
He consulted it more as a matter of form than anything else, for he knew very well where they were. With some sense that develops in true seamen, he was aware of the loom of the land, a dark presence beyond the horizon behind him, behind his right shoulder blade. They had been beating steadily up into the wind, and the pegs showed almost equal boards, east-northeast, followed by west-northwest. They had tacked 5 times. Sophie was not as quick in stays as he could have wished, and worn once, and they had been running at 7 knots. These calculations ran their course in his mind, and as soon as he looked for it, the answer was ready.
"Keep on this course for 30 minutes, and then put her almost before the wind. 2 points off. That will bring you home." "It would be as well to shorten sail now," he observed. "We will hold our course for 30 minutes.
With this he went below, meaning to do something in the way of dealing with the great mass of papers that called for attention. Apart from such things as the statement of stores and the pay-books, there was the Sophie's log, which would tell him something of the past history of the vessel, and her muster-book, which would do the same for her company. He leafed through the pages. "Sunday, September 22nd, 1799. Winds northwest, west, south. Course north 40 west, distance 49 miles. Latitude 37 degrees 59 minutes north. Longitude 9 degrees 38 minutes west. Cape St. Vincent, south 27 east, 64 miles. P.M. Fresh breezes and squally with rain. Made and shortened sail occasionally. A.M. Hard gales, and fore-handed the square mainsail. At 6, saw a strange sail to the southward. At 8, more moderate. Reefed the square mainsail, and set it. At 9, spoke her. She was a Swedish brig bound to Barcelona in ballast. At noon, weather calm, head round the compass." Dozens of entries of that kind of duty, and of convoy work. The plain, unspectacular, everyday sort of employment that made up 90% of a service life. Or more. "People variously employed. Read the Articles of War. Convoy in company, in t'gansels and second reef topsails. At 6 made private signal to 2 line-of-battle ships, which answered. All sails set. The people employed working up junk. Tacked occasionally in third reef main topsail. Light airs inclinable to calm. Scrubbed hammocks. Mustered by divisions. Read Articles of War and punished Joseph Wood, John Lakey, Matthew Johnson, and William Musgrave, with 12 lashes for drunkenness. P.M. Calm and hazy weather. At 5, out sweeps and boats to pull offshore.
At 6:30 came to, with the stream, anchor, Cape Mola, south, 6 west, distance 5 leagues. At 8:30, coming on to blow suddenly, was obliged to cut the hawser and make sail. Read the Articles of War, and performed divine service. Punished George Sennett with 24 lashes for contempt. Frank Betchell, Robert Wilkinson, and Joseph Wood for drunkenness.
A good many entries of that kind. A fair amount of flogging, but nothing heavy, none of your 100-lash sentences. It contradicted his first impression of laxity. He would have to look into it more thoroughly. Then the muster. George Williams, ordinary seaman, born Bengal, volunteered at Lisbon, 24th August 1797, ran 27th March 1798, Lisbon. Fortunato Canellia, midshipman, 21, born Genoa, discharged 1st June 1797, per order Rear Admiral Nelson per ticket. Samuel Wilsey, able seaman, born Long Island, volunteered Porto, 10th October 1797, ran 8th February 1799 at Lisbon from the boat. Patrick Wade, landman, 21, born County Fermanagh, pressed 20th November 1796 at Porto Ferraio, discharged 11th November 1799 to Bulldog, per order Captain Darley. Richard Sutton, lieutenant, joined 31st December 1796, per order Commodore Nelson, discharged dead 2nd February 1798, killed in action with a French privateer. Richard William Baldick, lieutenant, joined 28th February 1798, per commission from Earl St. Vincent, discharged 18th April 1800, to join Pallas, per order Lord Keith. In the column, Dead Men's Clothes, there was the sum of £8.10 and 6 against his name. Clearly poor Sutton's kit auctioned at the mainmast. But Jack could not keep his mind to the stiff, ruled column. The brilliant sea, darker blue than the sky, and the white wake across it kept drawing his eyes to the stern window. In the end, he closed the book and indulged himself in the luxury of staring out. If he chose, he could go to sleep, he reflected. And he looked around, relishing this splendid privacy, the rarest of commodities at sea. As a lieutenant in the Leander and other fair-sized ships, he had been able to look out of the wardroom windows, of course, but never alone, never unaccompanied by human presence and activity. It was wonderful. But it so happened that just now he longed for human presence and activity. His mind was too eager and restless to savour the full charm of solitude, although he knew it was there, and as soon as the ting-ting-ting-ting of 4 bells sounded, he was up on deck. Dillon and the master were standing by the starboard brass 4-pounder, and they were obviously discussing some part of her rigging visible from that point. As soon as he appeared, they moved over to the larboard side in the traditional way, leaving him his privileged area of the quarter-deck. This was the first time it had happened to him. He had not expected it, had not thought of it, and it gave him a ridiculous thrill of pleasure. But it also deprived him of a companion, unless he were to call James Dillon over. He took 2 or 3 turns, looking up at the yards. They were braced as sharp as the main and foremast shrouds would allow, but they were not as sharp as they might have been in an ideal world, and he made a mental note to tell the boatswain to set up cross catharpins. They might gain 3 or 4 degrees.
"Mr. Dillon," he said, "be so good as to bear up and set the square mainsail. South by west, a half south."
"Aye, aye, sir. Double reefed, sir?"
"No, Mr. Dillon, no reef," said Jack with a smile,
and he resumed his pacing. There were orders all round him, the trample of feet, the boatswain's calls. His eyes took in the whole of the operation with a curious detachment, curious because his heart was beating high. The Sophie paid off smoothly.
"Thus, thus,"
cried the master at the conn, and the helmsman steadied her. As she was coming round before the wind, the fore and aft mainsail vanished in billowing clouds that quickly subsided into the members of a long sailcloth parcel, greyish, inanimate. And immediately afterwards the square mainsail appeared, ballooning and fluttering for a few seconds, and then mastered, disciplined, and squared, with its sheets hauled aft. The Sophie shot forward, and by the time Dillon called, "Belay!" she had increased her speed by at least 2 knots, plunging her head and raising her stern as though she were surprised at her rider, as well she might have been. Dillon sent another man to the wheel, in case a fault in the wind should broach her too. The square mainsail was as taut as a drum.
"'Ask the word for the sailmaker,' said Jack. "'Mr. Henry, could you get me another cloth onto that sail? "'Wish you to take a deep, goring leech?'
"'No, sir,' said the sailmaker, positively.
"'Not if it was ever so. "'Not with that yard, sir. "'Look at all the horrible bunt there is now. "'More like what you might call a hog's bladder, properly speaking.'
Jack went to the rail and looked sharply at the sea running by, the long curve as it rose after the hollow under the lee bow. He grunted and returned to his staring at the mainyard, a piece of wood rather more than 30 feet long and tapering from some 7 inches in the slings, the middle part, to 3 at the yard-arms, the extremities.
"'More like a crow-jack than a mainyard,' he thought, for the 20th time since he first set eyes upon it.
He watched the yard intently as the force of the wind worked upon it. The Sophie was running no faster now, and so there was no longer any easing of the load. The yard plied, and it seemed to Jack that he heard it groan. The Sophie's braces led forward, of course, she being a brig, and the plying was greatest at the yard-arms, which irked him. But there was some degree of bowing all along. He stood there with his hands behind his back, his eyes set upon it. And the other officers on the quarter-deck, Dillon, Marshall, Pullings, and young Ricketts, stood attentively, not speaking, looking sometimes at their new captain and sometimes at the sail. They were not the only men to wonder, for most of the more experienced hands on the forecastle had joined in this double scrutiny, a gaze up, then a sidelong stare at Jack. It was a strange atmosphere. Now that they were before the wind, or very nearly, that is to say, now that they were going in the same direction as the wind, nearly all the song had gone out of the rigging. The Sophie's long, slow pitching, no cross-sea to move her quickly, made little noise, and added to this there was the strained quietness of men murmuring together, not to be heard. But in spite of their care, a voice drifted back to the quarter-deck.
"'He'll carry all away if he cracks on so.'
Jack did not hear it. He was quite unconscious of the tension around him, far away in his calculations of the opposing forces, not mathematical calculations by any means, but rather sympathetic, the calculations of a rider with a new horse between his knees and a dark hedge coming. Presently he went below, and after he had stared out of the stern window for some time, he looked at the chart. Cape Mola would be on their starboard now. They should raise it very soon, and it would add a little greater thrust to the wind by deflecting it along the coast. Very quietly he whistled, "De vieni," reflecting.
"If I make a success of this, if I make a mint of money, several hundred guineas, say, the first thing I shall do after paying off is to go to Vienna, to the opera."
James Dillon knocked on the door.
"The wind is increasing, sir," he said. "May I hand the mainsail, or reef at least?"
"No, no, Mr. Dillon, no," said Jack, smiling.
Then, reflecting that it was scarcely fair to leave this on his lieutenant's shoulders, he added,
"I shall come on deck in 2 minutes."
In fact, he was there in less than one, just in time to hear the ominous, rending crack.
"Up sheets!" he cried. "Hands to the jeers! Topsail clew lines! Clap on to the lifts! Lower away cheerily! Look alive there!"
They looked alive. The yard was small. Soon it was on deck, the sail unbent, the yard stripped, and everything coiled down.
"'Hopelessly sprung in the slings, sir,' said the carpenter sadly. He was having a wretched day of it.
"'I could try to fish it, but it would never be answerable, like.'
Jack nodded without any particular expression. He walked across to the rail, put a foot on to it, and hoisted himself up into the first ratlins. The Sophie rose on the swell, and there indeed lay Cape Mola, a dark bar 3 points on the starboard beam.
"'I think we must touch up the lookout,' he observed. "'Lay her for the harbour, Mr. Dillon, if you please. Boom mainsail and everything she can carry. There's not a minute to lose.'
45 minutes later the Sophie picked up her moorings, and before the way was off her the cutter splashed into the water, the sprung yard was already afloat, and the boat set off urgently in the direction of the wharf, towing the yard behind like a streaming tail.
"'Well, there's the fleet's own brazen smiling serpent,' remarked Bow Oar, as Jack ran up the steps. "'Brings the poor old Sophie in, first time he ever set foot on her, with barely a yard standing at all. Her timbers all crazy and half the ship's company pumping for dear life, and every man on deck the livelong day, dear knows, with never a pause for the smell of a pipe. And he runs up them old steps, smiling like King George was at the top there to knight him.'
"'And short time for dinner as will never be made up,' said a low voice in the middle of the boat.
"'Silence!' cried Mr. Babington, with as much outrage as he could manage.
"'Mr. Brown,' said Jack, with an earnest look, "'you can do me a very essential service, if you will. "'I have sprung my mainyard hopelessly. "'I am concerned to tell you, and yet I must sail this evening. "'The Fanny is in. "'So I beg you to condemn it and issue me out another in its place. "'Nay, never look so shocked, my dear sir.' he said, taking Mr. Brown's arm and leading him towards the cutter. "'I am bringing you back the 12 pounders, ordnance being now within your purview, as I understand, because I feared the sloop might be overburdened.'
"'With all my heart,' said Mr. Brown, looking at the awful chasm in the yard, held up mutely for his inspection by the cutter's crew. "'But there is not another spar in the yard small enough for you.'
"'Come, sir, you are forgetting the general.' She had 3 spare for the gallant yards, as well as a vast mound of other spars, and you will be the first to admit that I have a moral right to one.
Well, you may try it, if you wish. You may sway it up to let us see what it looks like, but I make no promise.
Let my men take it out, sir. I remember just where they are stowed. Mr. Babington, 4 men. Come along now, look alive.
It is only on trial, remember, Captain Aubrey, called Mr. Brown. I will watch you sway it up.
"'Now that is what he call a real spar,'
said Mr. Lamb, peering lovingly over the side at the yard. "'Never a knot, never a curl. A French spar, I dare say. 43 foot, as clean as a whistle. You'll spread a mainsail as a mainsail on that, sir.'
"'Yes, yes,' said Jack impatiently. "'Is that hawser brought to the capstan yet?'
"'Hawser too, sir,' came the reply after a moment's pause.
"'Then heave away.'
The hawser had been made fast to the middle of the yard, and then laid along it, almost to its starboard extremity, being tied in 6 places from the slings to the yardarm with stoppers, bands of spun yarn. The hawser ran from the yardarm up to the top block at the masthead, and so down through another block on deck, and thence to the capstan. So as the capstan turned, the yard rose from the water, sloping more and more nearly to the vertical, until it came abroad quite upright. "'Steered carefully end on through the rigging.
"'Cut the outer stopper,' said Jack.
"'The spun yard dropped, and the yard canted a little, held by the next. "'As it rose, so the other stoppers were out, "'and when the last went, the yard swung square, neatly under the top.
"'It will never do, Captain Aubrey,' called Mr. Brown,
"'hailing over the quiet evening air through his trumpet.
"'It is far too large, and will certainly carry away. "'You must saw off the yard arms and half the third quarter.'
Lying stark and bare, like the arms of an immense pair of scales, the yard certainly did look somewhat over-large.
"'Hitch on the runners,' said Jack.
"'No, farther out. Halfway to the second quarter. Surge the hawser and lower away.'
The yard came down on deck, and the carpenter hurried off for his tools.
"'Mr. Watt,' said Jack to the boatswain, "'just rig me the brace pendants, will you?'
The boatswain opened his mouth, shut it again, and bent slowly to his work. Anywhere outside Bedlam, brace pendants were rigged after the horses, after the stirrups, after the yard-tackle pendants, or a thimble for the tackle-hook, if preferred, and none of them ever until the stop-cleat, the narrow part for them all to rest upon, had been worked on the sawn-off end and provided with a collar to prevent them from drawing in towards the middle. The carpenter reappeared with a saw and a rule.
"'Have you a plane there, Mr. Lamb?'
asked Jack.
"'Your mate will fetch you a plane.' "'Unship the stunsail boom iron, and touch up the ends of the stop cleats, Mr. Lamb, if you please.'
Lamb, amazed until he grasped what Jack was about, slowly planed the tips of the yard, shaving off wafers until they showed new and white, around the size of a halfpenny bun.
"'That will do,' said Jack. "'Sway her up again, bracing her round easy all the time, square with the key. Mr. Dillon, I must go ashore.' "'Return the guns to the ordnance wharf, and stand off and on for me in the channel. "'We must sail before the evening gun. "'Oh, and Mr. Dillon, all the women ashore.'
"'All the women without exception, sir?'
"'All without their lines. All the trollops. "'Trollops are capital things in port, but they will not do at sea.'
"'He paused, ran down to his cabin, and came back 2 minutes later, "'stuffing an envelope into his pocket.
"'Yard again!'
he cried, dropping into the boat.
"'You will be glad you took my advice.' said Mr. Brown, receiving him at the steps. "'It would certainly have carried away with the first puff of wind.'
"'May I take the duettos now, sir?'
asked Jack, with a certain pang.
"'I'm just about to fetch the friend I was speaking of. A great musician, sir. You must meet him when next we are in Mahone. You must allow me to present him to Mrs. Brown.'
"'Should be honoured, most happy,' said Mr. Brown.
"Ground steps now, and give way like heroes,"
said Jack, returning at a shambling run with the book. Like so many sailors, he was rather fat, and he sweated easily on shore.
6 minutes in hand,"
he said, peering at his watch in the twilight as they came in to the landing.
"Why, there you are, Doctor. I do hope you will forgive me for ratting on you this afternoon. Shanahan, Bustle, you two come with me. The others stay in the boat."